they introduced a new type of visa, which is a job seeker visa, they call it. It is specifically targeted for people who has degree or who has extensive in experience in certain field, and this is IT is included in that.
Oh, engineering.
IT means like engineering, system administration, database, everything. It covers all the computer science, engineering, and everything related to computers, basically. So that if you have degree and some experience, you can apply this visa from an embassy. You need to show that the Germany, of course, recognize your university. That could be the maybe the tricky part to get if it is not already recognized.
Xin chào tất cả mọi người, chào mừng các bạn trở lại podcast Đọc sách với Nguyễn Việt Linh. Thời gian trôi quá là nhanh, ngày này một năm trước là ngày 12 tháng 1 năm 2020, là ngày mà tập đầu tiên của podcast Đọc sách với Nguyễn Việt Linh được lên sóng. Trải qua một năm với 18 tập, chúng ta đã cùng nhau đọc những cuốn sách ở nhiều chủ đề khác nhau, từ là triết học này, cho đến tài chính này, tình yêu này, công nghệ này, rồi là tâm lý này. Mình rất cảm ơn các bạn đã luôn dành thời gian lắng nghe và ủng hộ podcast này. Mình bắt đầu từ con số 0 và hiện giờ cũng đã có thêm những bạn ủng hộ và thậm chí là quen được những người bạn mới. Sau khi tập nói chuyện đầu tiên với khách mời Tuấn Đỗ, tập 16, được phát sóng thì nhiều bạn cũng đã gửi email cho mình và cũng rất ủng hộ những cuộc nói chuyện với các bạn chuyên về một lĩnh vực nào đó. Vì vậy, hôm nay mình sẽ tiếp tục cuộc nói chuyện với một vị khách mời. Vị khách ngày hôm nay là Ahmed, người bạn đến từ Thổ Nhĩ Kỳ. Ahmed tốt nghiệp tiến sĩ từ Đại học Bách khoa Milan ở Ý, chuyên ngành khoa học kỹ thuật máy tính. Chuyên ngành hẹp của anh là phát triển hệ thống nhúng cho trí tuệ nhân tạo AI. Anh hiện là kỹ sư phần mềm cho một công ty chuyên về hệ thống nhúng cho xe hơi ở Đức. Vì thế là tập hôm nay sẽ là buổi nói chuyện bằng tiếng Anh. Ahmed và mình dành khoảng 20 phút đầu để trao đổi một chút về chuyên ngành của anh. Nên có thể khoảng 20 phút đầu sẽ rất là khó hiểu với những bạn nào mà không quen thuộc ngành này. Phần còn lại thì Ahmed sẽ chia sẻ với chúng ta những kinh nghiệm làm nghiên cứu sinh tiến sĩ, rồi là phỏng vấn, tìm việc và xin visa ở Đức. Hy vọng là các bạn sẽ hứng thú, ít nhất là phần sau của cuộc nói chuyện.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Talk. Today, the episode is in English and our guest today is Ahmed Adam. Ahmed got his PhD in computer science and engineering, specialized in embedded system for artificial intelligence in Polytechnic University of Milan in Italy, and he's currently a software engineer for an automotive company. Ahmed, thanks for coming here today.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here and talking to you. Yeah, I'm just finished my PhD and moving on to industry for software engineering in a company in Germany called Ambition, but without the A in the beginning. So
okay.
It's a part of an automotive company, Mercedes.
So it's a pun.
Yeah, it's a pun. Yeah, exactly.
So we know like today, so we are having a trend of data science or machine learning, right? Why would you choose to study the embedded system for AI? I mean, it's really low level of computing. And in my opinion, it's not really common nowadays.
Actually, it was more of an opportunity when I was when I met the professor that I the supervisor of my PhD program, and she basically proposed to me an industrial PhD opportunity that was in this field. However, I think that although the trend of machine learning or artificial intelligence is like hype now. And mostly it's like high level
implementation
and mostly focused on algorithms, or you hear in the news or on the tech journals about the new trendy networks and other stuff. All these frameworks works with quite low level implementations. I mean, maybe not for directly for embedded systems, but all these TensorFlow or PyTorch, like famous frameworks, they have a lot of low-level implementations that are quite complicated and diverse for different platforms. Mm. Some maybe works with the graphics cards better, and some are very fine-tuned for training purposes, especially for multiple clusters of computing. Although low level is not trendy anymore, at least as far as I can see from the, let's say, industry also. But there is a hype over the embedded systems now, that the training procedure or the theory behind the AI is getting more and more established.
Mm.
And it's becoming more and more common. So it starts to the product are start to be mature enough that you can move safely to those kind of implementations that are already trained, to lower, more resource constrained platforms that becomes feasible. So that's what I saw as an opportunity to, like, let's say, study and research about it. So that's why it was a passion for me. I mean, personally, I came from more lower level background, so okay. AI was the new stuff for me.
For me, like I saw a lot of my friends who did the data science, so what they are doing was quite straightforward. So they just import Keras, import TensorFlow, STF, and then fit, and then dot print. Well, I mean, it's oversimplified statement, but I mean, how hard to convert just piece of code into the real-time computing?
Okay, so it depends a lot on what you're actually doing, of course. So it can be quite hard, but at the same time, depends what you are doing. It can be quite very straightforward, almost one-to-one mapping. Let's take more simple example. If you consider, for example, NumPy,
mm-hmm.
is actually the core of it is C++, and it's actually handwritten vectorized code, which means that it takes advantage and exploits some parts of the processor very specifically, so that it can do very fast processing. It is quite efficient, and from the Python level, you don't even notice or care about this.
Mm, yeah.
But actually, some procedures in NumPy, especially things that are like vector multiplication or summation, those arithmetic operations, they are almost one-to-one mapping to the C-level things. The thing gets complicated, of course, when you start to think about memory, because usually the higher-level languages, the concept of memory is quite simplified. It's managed for you, and you don't need to care about when you allocate, when you deallocate, or where is it exactly. Mm-hmm. For C-level, you have to think about it, or C++, non-managed languages. Manual memory management languages. But if you go to the level of like Keras, TensorFlow or PyTorch, where you have a model of a quite complicated neural network,
mm-hmm.
it becomes quite tricky to make a low-level implementation. You can actually make it simple, which is like one-to-one, but at that point you don't get anything better than what is available mostly in the Python level, because you don't exploit what is available to you then.
Okay,
it means that you are doing very straightforward implementation.
Mm-hmm.
If the workload, your model, if it is not super suitable to the actual machine, you will not get the speeds near enough to the PyTorch or Keras. In the end, though, those frameworks underneath, they have complicated set of multiple layers of software stack that take your graph and then transform it in different ways depending on what machine you are running, and make it more suitable, then generate the code after that. Quite complicated now, but it's at the same time very easy, especially if you are from data science or machine learning scientist perspective, that the things that you can do are limitless, but it's usually because of there are people already take care of the complicated parts and give you the tools.
I guess the challenges are like the memory and spaces, right? Because you know, like at a higher level, like MATLAB or Python,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the interpretation language,
mm-hmm.
right? The language need to be first interpret it.
Yes.
And then compile later, right?
Yes.
And in C and C++, it's a compiling language. Mm-hmm. This means it can run straightforward. But in my opinion, like, people still prefer Python because mm-hmm. like it's easy for implementation. Like, the cost of developing the code is much more lower than the C, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there is a trade-off, like everywhere in any part of engineering. Here, mm-hmm. there is a big trade-off between do you want to ease and flexibility and comfort so that you can build actually more complicated stuff. Yeah. In that case, you can go with the PyTorch. But if your actual workload needs to run super, super fast, takes advantage of everything available, then you have to consider manually memory managed or the most completely compiled native languages like C, C++.
Mm.
However, I have to like emphasize that most of the things that are like used in Python, that when you take advantage of some frameworks or when you do the import some stuff and then you write your code and you make your own model, or you just use NumPy to calculate some stuff, what is you are taking advantage of mostly this already written and compiled code.
Okay.
What you are doing is actually gluing different parts of the computations together, and since the part that you write as a Python developer or a software programmer, the part that you are introducing is so insignificant, insignificant in terms of computation, in terms of amount of multiplications, amount of plus and minuses. Mm-hmm. So it's not significant in that sense. It's significant, of course, you are composing something together with multiple parts.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's not introducing computation so much, and all the compute and memory heavy parts, they are already being optimized and compiled for you as like function calls, it takes advantage of both sides of the trade-off.
Okay.
And that's actually one of the biggest benefits of doing Python. Even though I am working on embedded systems, we still use Python for creating our models, for creating test cases, for many, many stuff. I mean, there are even some companies that are doing from Python. They do Python for micro embedded systems because it can still be useful, especially if the work and the application is not computation heavy.
So I also learned the embedded system and C and C++. But when I heard your story, my brain was also exploding. So it's quite complicated. So I guess we have to ask another question.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we are not going to go through your thesis right? So let's move to an easier topic. Mm-hmm. So about your PhD. I want to talk about your master and your PhD journey. You are coming here with the scholarship, right?
Yes. Basically, I did my bachelor in Turkey. It was 2013 I finished.
Okay.
And I had an opportunity here because I had a scholarship for master's degree from, again, Politecnico di Milano. But I was going to choose the sound engineering track in master's. However, after some...
Like accounting engineering, right? You play the signal processing for the audio signals, right?
Yes. It was mostly like for digital signal processing. So like, how can we make systems that can do mastering and maybe create virtual instruments so that you can help musicians and other kind of stuff. Or they were doing some acoustic experiments in anechoic chambers, chambers that you cannot have any kind of sound waves reflecting. So there were some complications, but it was still under computer engineering and science degree. Mm-hmm. So I had the flexibility to choose something else for my master thesis. And after I get an advanced computer architecture course, I decided to continue to my thesis on GPU and CPU programming. So heterogeneous programming, it's mm-hmm. called. It means that how can we split the workload, where it will run on, which one it will run on GPU, which one on CPU.
Mm-hmm.
After I finished my thesis, then I had this opportunity to do this PhD degree. I didn't have the freedom to choose my topic exactly because it was something called Borsa di Tema in Italy, which means that your topic is defined and you get scholarship from that for that topic. I was a little bit skeptical in the beginning because it's not industry, it's like academia, do I want it? It's a hard question. The sponsorship for the scholarship was coming from industrial partner, and I had to spend some time in the company of this partner. So that's why it's considered as industrial PhD, and I thought, okay, that it's better in that sense that I can pursue this journey.
Yeah, industrial PhD is one of the new term, right?
Yeah,
because it's like a combination between the real world experience with theory, right? I've seen like a lot of my friends also like follow the PhD, but usually in the theory.
Exactly. I mean, I was not super aware back then when I started, but since last year of my PhD, I was basically searching job and realized that there are a lot of companies that are actually offering industrial PhD because it's beneficial for them because they don't pay income taxes because it's a scholarship.
Okay. So smart move.
And it's beneficial for the universities because they don't need to pay for the researchers, at least the young researchers.
So it's a win-win. Yeah?
It's a win-win for everyone. It's fantastic. Also for the companies, because usually people who want to consider PhD is usually in the top 10% of the class. Mm. So it means that company is also getting the good candidates. Mm. So it's beneficial for them, for everyone. So I realized that it's much more common now than I started to have industrial PhD around. Yeah.
The scholarship is enough for you to cover every expenses here in Italy?
For my master's, I had to receive some financial support from my parents because it was not enough. It was mainly covering my accommodation. Mm-hmm. Which is huge thing in Italy.
Well, I mean, in everywhere. Accommodation is always accounting for like 50%
yes,
of the income.
Exactly. So after accommodation, I had a little bit of money left, but usually it was not enough. Mm-hmm. For PhD, though, the scholarship I had was more or less the same as the entry-level worker, software engineer in Italy. So it was enough. It's nothing big.
And no tax.
So I mean, it's a scholarship. The thing that mattered to me also, since it's a scholarship, it's not a salary actually, officially. So I didn't have, for example, work permit.
Okay.
I had the student permit. For the resident permit, I had the student study type. For Turkey, it affected because I had to do my military service after I finished the studies, no? Or close. If I had the work permit, I could just pay for my military. Mm-hmm. But because I had study permit, for example, I couldn't skip military. I had to do it.
I see. Would you enjoy the PhD? Of course, most of the work you need to do is to be a researcher.
Yeah.
But you need also to be a lecturer, teaching assistant,
yes,
to be more precise. How is the experience to be a teaching assistant in the country? You have to use English to teach. How does this feel?
It was quite scary in the beginning, I have to admit, because I didn't have any experience. PhD includes, of course, many different type of work. Actually, just to do, you need to do research, you need to publish. For industrial PhD, it also means that you need to work sometime for practical, for development purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, you need to do some kind of small, tiny works for your supervisor. Usually it means that sometimes your supervisor comes and says, like, you know, I have these kind of papers, they need to be reviewed.
Mm.
And you ask, when should I do it? You have only until tomorrow. And you have four conference paper that you have to review.
Panicking, right?
Yes, yes. So then you stop everything and then you just for 2 days or 1.5 days straight, you just try to finish. On top of this, that you every year more or less you have to do teaching assistant, as you said. It's quite scary in the beginning because you are in another country. You have to use English, which is not my native language, and you have to go in front of a class with 80 people, maybe 100 people, and you have to try to explain them a topic. Usually, you get extra paid for the teaching assistant. At least in my university, it's like that. The thing is that it usually doesn't exactly worth it because it says, for example, if you have a course, it says 20 hours of teaching assistantship. You apply for it, you get to be teaching assistant. Okay, so you get paid for 20 hours, whatever per hour wage is it. The problem is that for that 20 hours, you need to study maybe 40 hours more. Then you need to do the 20 hours of the teaching, because especially if it's the first time that you are doing for that course, you need to almost recap every corner of that topic so that you can teach it, because maybe you took that course 2 years ago, maybe not even you never took that course. So you need to study extra just to be ahead of all those students that are actually taking it. This is kind of troubling, but I have to say that teaching in front of the class after you get used to it has a different kind of pleasure, and it's different kind of satisfaction that you get from it. It's weird, especially if after the first couple of class of that year, you started to have some kind of connection with the people because they started to be more relax and they can ask questions because they know you, and then there is like a small technical discussions going on, so it could be enjoyable also, but I would say that it's usually for PhD students it's a quite time consuming and it doesn't contribute to your thesis, so it's usually seen as a waste of time or obstacle for PhD student. I think at least a couple of years gives you some soft skills that you cannot get it from just technical work. Yeah, this is something that you get it through experience, and it's kind of unique soft skill that maybe even people in the industry, they don't know. Because teaching has quite delicate matters that you need to be able to understand if the audience is completely they completely lost you, or they are still on track, how much they understand. Maybe you need to make an intentional mistake so that people can, to see if people are still following or not. This is kind of a skill or experience that you need to develop, and it's I don't know how you can get it otherwise.
This also is a chance for you to review again, right?
Yes.
It just means like when you teach something for somebody, you should understand what it you say or what you already know about, right?
Yes.
I know to do the PhD, to choose the professor is really important.
Yes.
And I know lots of people who quit the PhD because their supervisors are terrible.
Yes.
So how do you deal with the conflicts in that relationship?
Very good question. Perfect. I mean, for PhD, I mean, very important which advisor you are going to have. It has immense effect on your whole academic career if you are following or all the duration of the PhD program that you are having. And there are like some advisors that are, I believe, almost impossible to work with. I was slightly lucky, at least in the sense that it was not another obstacle. But PhD program and also research or starting a research is a quite challenging task. Either way, you are going to have some conflicts or some problems with the professor or the people you are working with. The very important thing is that you have to be in good terms with your advisor almost all the time, I believe, because in the end, they are supposed to be there to support you and make sure that you can graduate.
Mm-hmm.
However, also in my case, it's usually that they are not following you very closely. And most of the time, they are super busy.
Mm.
And
lots of students
or depends on the level of, because academia is a very hierarchical place, even though it's not like military. Depending on the position of the professor, they might have practical sides so that they can still understand and they can contribute, they can discuss with you, they can follow you closely, maybe they can even do some development with you or jumpstart you to the project, or they can be super high level, almost managerial level, that they can be the leader of the research group,
mm-hmm.
which means that they are overseeing 2-3 other professors,
mm-hmm.
so they are almost not doing anything related to the actual practical things.
Okay.
So, and they don't do it for a very long time, which means that once you have a problem, you are on your own. That's the one big thing in the PhD, that you are mostly independent, which is double-edged sword. So it's a good thing, but it also means that you are on your own when there is a problem. You are very specific, very narrow topic, so that they can only give you very general advice, which you already probably know it.
Yeah, okay.
Then there could be also other kind of problems, especially in my case. I would say I had problems because I have also industrial side. And the goals of the industrial side and the goals of the university, they don't align.
Mm-hmm.
One part wants to do development or more practical things, which are really hard to publish because they are also confidential.
Mm-hmm.
So they are industrial secrets. The other part wants you to do as many as papers you publish.
As possible.
As possible, yes. So you need to bring those two together in the same and under the same umbrella. And it's basically compromise from both sides. So you have to negotiate. Sometimes you need to explain with all the reasoning and whatever the cause it is to your professor that you cannot use that kind of options because of this and that, and you need to sometimes like stand your ground a little bit, or when you are discussing technical stuff with your professor, especially in my case, because my supervisor is on a higher level in the sense that she does not go into the very detail of the actual thing. So if she is talking and explaining it to you, especially, and if you are alone, this is very important, she's going to do some mistakes because she is not on the practical side. It's your job to correct her or him in a respectable manner. And especially if you are alone, I think you can do this much easier. But with a lot of other people, it's much trickier. And you should try to discuss things and correct your supervisor when you are alone, so that when you are with a lot of people, or if you are in a conference or in with your whole team, that your supervisor is mostly correct.
No public criticism.
Yeah.
Can you share with us about the way you find a job in Germany? Is it from your advisor or is from your company you are doing your industrial PhD?
Okay, in my case, she was not super useful to find my next step, let's say. However, I know other PhD students of her that she helped to find them, or at least find some contacts and offer for the next stage. In my case, I started long before I told her that I will not continue the academic career. I started searching before. I target Germany quite specifically as a job search. It was
For personal reasons.
For personal reasons, yeah. In the beginning, let's say, before I start applying jobs in Germany, I did quite a lot of background search to find potential interesting companies and their backgrounds, and I try to track them a little bit. especially there are like some platforms that you can see and read other people's reviews for those companies. Like I was using Glassdoor mainly, mm-hmm. but there are also other websites.
Which website do you find the current job?
I used Glassdoor. Because Glassdoor is much more international, so it's easier to find English reviews there.
Okay.
That was the reason. But for Germany, later I discovered there are many other platforms, mm-hmm. but they are mostly German language. So if you don't have the second foreign language as German, it's quite hard to make sense of it. There are like Kununu, there is Zing, it's X-I-N-G.
X-I-N-S-I-N-G.
Yes. Sing. Yes.
Sing.com,
yes. Or, I mean, there is also LinkedIn, but LinkedIn can be a lot of noise. So I tried LinkedIn, but I was not so happy about it.
Okay.
After a couple of months of this research, I start applying. Problem is that especially I started in summer, it was the lockdowns, pandemic, it's the chaos. Everybody said to me that it will take longer mm-hmm. to process. The fastest people who returned to my job applications, they returned after 3 weeks or 1 month.
Okay. How many rounds you have to go through for one job application?
In my case, with my current position, I had to go, it was 4 rounds, mm-hmm. yes. And it was quite unusual because you expect to have first like HR round, no?
Human resources.
This was opposite. I was also surprised. This was with a technical manager,
okay,
and a system architect.
Mm-hmm.
And it was semi-technical. Semi-technical means they were asking what kind of frameworks that I use, what is my approach to the general development,
mm-hmm.
what is my thesis about, how much practical experience I have, and there were some soft skill and team building questions like, can you describe us your ideal dream team?
Mm-hmm.
How would it be?
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an interesting question, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And second interview was with a senior developer. That was super technical.
Hardcore.
I mean, it was not super hard, but it was basically like, how would you use C++? What do you know about this kind of standard library? It's more specific. And at the end, there was a live coding session they asked a question, and it was an algorithm question. It was not super specific to what they are trying to solve,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know how much they can share with me at that time, especially.
Okay.
But it was still an algorithm question. Actually, it was more data structures, which means that if you choose the wrong data structure, it was impossible to solve it. But it was not super hard. The only thing is that when you don't know that there will be live coding and they say, okay, let's start, you get a little bit stressful, no? But in the end, like I solved it in one way, and the guy said he didn't know that it was possible to solve that way, and he said he wanted me to simplify it and solve it in another way.
Mm-hmm.
Then I stuck at some point, for example, because I was still thinking in the first way, because it first one was with recursion. And so I couldn't, let's say, rethink completely at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But he was helpful. He gave me tips and tricks so that after that it was easy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not like they want you to, okay, be the ninja programmer to do everything the mm-hmm. first effective, most efficient way. But they were quite comfortable
mm-hmm.
To solve it. And that was the two technical interviews. Mm-hmm. After that, all the interviews, they were like HR interviews, like personal questions, mm-hmm. like what is your strengths or stuff like that.
Interesting to know.
Yeah.
Is it hard to obtain the working visa in Germany?
No, especially for Germany, no, because Germany has changed its laws in March 2020. and because they have a lot of positions for IT, so generally IT, okay, medicine and some other fields, big market, they don't have enough trained personnel.
Okay.
So they introduced a new type of visa, which is a job seeker visa, they call it. It is specifically targeted for people who has degree or who has extensive in experience in certain field. And this is IT is included in that.
Oh, engineering.
IT means like engineering, okay, system administration, database, everything. It covers all the computer science, engineering, and everything related to computers, basically. So that if you have degree and some experience, you can apply this visa from an embassy. You need to show that the Germany, of course, recognize your university. That could be the tricky part to get if it is not already recognized. Mm-hmm. But they have a database that shows which universities and which programs they recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Probably all of the European universities is in that database.
Okay.
So, I mean, they check with that database because they need to match for if you do computer engineering or science, they need to match a certain degree type in Germany so that they can give you a title, job title in the official documents. So I basically apply for job search visa and it was fast. I think I got it in 3 weeks or something, mm-hmm, like that. I mean, it's fast for Italy.
Surprisingly, so I'm
happy. And it's a job search visa. You don't need a contract for job search visa.
Okay.
So you just need to write a motivation letter, why you want to be in Germany, what is your plan for a job search, and if you have any already contacts with the companies, if you have which ones,
mm-hmm,
and what you want to do in Germany in general. Up to 6 months they give jobs.
Okay, so we can write in English, right?
Yeah, the motivation letter is in English. Actually, they don't even expect a language certification,
okay,
for Germany.
Good to know.
For this visa, I don't know the other ones, but
okay,
the job
okay
search visa, they didn't require.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
For how long for the job search visa? And also, I'm curious about the financial condition for this type of visa.
The condition is that you need to provide, you need to show X amount per month in a blocked account in Germany. That X changes every year. And this year it was 863, if I remember correctly. So you need to show a minimum 863 euro per month in a German account.
Okay, and it's totally blocked.
And
we cannot use it until we are in Germany.
Yeah, until you are in Germany, you cannot use it. It works like every month they give you this 863 euro, like a pocket money.
Okay.
So you can only withdraw that much amount every month,
mm-hmm,
when you go to Germany. So for me, for 6 months, because job search visa is 6 months, it means roughly it is around 5,200 euros, roughly.
It's a bank account?
Yes, in a German bank account, German blocked bank account,
okay.
Yeah.
It seems the condition is not so strict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anyone graduating from European university with proper saving can apply.
Exactly. They are trying to attract people because they need people to go there and start working, especially in IT and medicine. So I think it's important to know, because this is a kind of new visa, no?
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the pandemic situation, people stop moving around, so
yeah,
maybe they stop searching for foreign job opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be an opportunity to pursue.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So today is a pleasure to listen to you. I think we know and understand an amount of valuable information from the experience in doing the PhD, mock interview and coding to job search visa application in Germany. So Ahmed, thank you very much for sharing today.
It was a pleasure to be here and talking to you.
New Như vậy, qua buổi nói chuyện ngày hôm nay, mình cũng biết thêm được nhiều thứ. Hiện tại thì có lẽ là Python là ngôn ngữ lập trình phổ biến nhất, được dùng kể cả trong hệ thống nhúng, có thể được dùng từ đầu đến cuối của một dự án sử dụng trí tuệ nhân tạo. Một trong những lý do đó là ngôn ngữ Python có một lượng các thư viện mã nguồn mở rất là phong phú. Những mã nguồn đó gần như đã được tối ưu và có thể được sử dụng với tốc độ rất nhanh. Python cũng là một dạng ngôn ngữ với cú pháp được tối giản. Nên như vậy, chúng ta có thể thấy rất nhiều người dù không có nền tảng công nghệ đã có thể dễ dàng tiếp cận hoặc chuyển đổi ngành học sang học máy, trí tuệ nhân tạo rồi là dữ liệu. Tất cả những ngành đó hiện tại đều dùng ngôn ngữ Python. Ngoài ra, thì cuộc nói chuyện còn giúp chúng ta biết thêm được những kinh nghiệm làm nghiên cứu sinh tiến sĩ, đặc biệt là Industrial PhD, mình cứ gọi là nghiên cứu sinh tiến sĩ công nghiệp, rồi là dạng visa tìm việc và những chia sẻ của Ahmed khi anh phỏng vấn. Hy vọng các bạn hứng thú với cuộc nói chuyện vừa rồi và tiếp tục đón chờ những tập tiếp theo. Mình rất mong chờ phản hồi của các bạn về tập này và cả podcast này. Nếu các bạn yêu thích những cuộc nói chuyện như thế này nữa, thì mình sẽ cố gắng mời thêm nhiều khách mời đến chia sẻ hơn. Các bạn có thể gửi inbox cho mình hay là giới thiệu những quyển sách hay cho mình thông qua email docsachvoinguyenvietlinh@gmail.com. Hãy cùng học hỏi và phát triển từng tập và hãy là những người xuất chúng. Mình là Nguyễn Việt Linh và các bạn đang lắng nghe podcast Đọc sách với Nguyễn Việt Linh.